They went on, night after stifling night, week after wearying week, and month after gruelling month. The knife wound in Taita's shoulder healed cleanly in the hot, dry air, but the horses sickened and faltered, and the men were flagging long before they reached the second cataract. This was where Taita and Queen Lostris had rested for a season to await the renewed flood of the Nile, which would ensure sufficient depth for the galleys to surmount the cataract. Taita looked down upon the settlement they had built. The stone walls were still standing. The ruins of the crude royal palace he had built to shelter Lostris. Those were the lands where they had planted the Dara crop, still demarcated by the furrows of the wooden ploughshare. Those were the stands of tall trees from which they had cut the timber to build chariots and repair the battered hulls of the galleys. The trees were still alive, sustained by the deep roots that reached down to the underground pools and streams. Over there was the forge that the coppersmiths had built. "Magus, look to the pool below the cataract," Merrin had ridden up beside him, and his excited cry interrupted Taita's memories. He looked in the direction Merrin was pointing. Was it a trick of the early light, he wondered? "Look at the colour of the water. It is no longer blood-red. The pool is green, as green as a sweet melon." "It might be another ruse of the witch," Taita doubted his eyes, but already Merrin was racing down the slope, standing high in his stirrups and yelling, his men following him. Taita and Windsmoke maintained a more sedate and dignified pace to the edge of the pool, which was lined now with men, horses, and mules. The animals' heads were down, and they were sucking up the green water like shadoofs, the water wheels of the peasant farmers, as the men scooped handfuls to pour it over their own faces and down their throats. Windsmoke sniffed the water suspiciously, then began to drink. Taita loosened her girth rope to allow her belly to expand. Like a pig's bladder, she blew up before his eyes. He left her to it and waded out into the pool, then sat down. The tepid water reached his chin, and he closed his eyes, an ecstatic smile on his face. "Magus," Merrin called from the bank, "this is your doing, I am sure. You have cured the river of her foul disease, is it not so?" Merrin's faith in him was limitless and touching. It would not do to disappoint him. Taita opened his eyes to see that 100 men were waiting attentively for his reply. It was also prudent to build their trust in him. He smiled at Merrin, then dropped his right eyelid in an enigmatic wink. Merrin looked smug, and the men cheered. They waded into the pool, still in sandals and shirts, and splashed sheets of water at each other, then wrestled each other's heads beneath the surface. Taita left them to their revelry and waded to the bank. By this time, Windsmoke was so bloated with both water and foal that she waddled rather than walked. He took her to roll in the crisp white river sand and sat down. While he watched her, he pondered the change in their fortunes and the miracle of the clear water that Merrin had ascribed to him. "This is as far as the contamination has spread," he decided. "From here southwards the river will be clear. Wasted and shrivelled, but clear." They camped that morning in the shade of the grove. "Magus, I plan to stay at this place until the horses are recovered. If we go on immediately, we will begin to lose them," Merrin said. Taita nodded. "You are wise," he said. "I know this place well. I lived here for a full season during the Great Exodus. There are plants in the forest whose leaves the horses will eat. They are rich in nutrients and will put fat and condition on them within days. And Windsmoke will soon drop her foal. It'll have a better chance of survival here than out in the desert," Taita thought, but did not say. Merrin was speaking animatedly. "I saw the tracks of oryx near the pool. The men will enjoy hunting them and be grateful for the fine meat. We can dry and smoke the rest to take with us when we ride again." Taita stood up. "I will go to search out fodder for the animals." "I will come with you. I want to see more of this little paradise." They wandered together among the trees, and Taita pointed out edible shrubs and vines. They were desert-adapted and hardened to the drought conditions. Sheltered from direct sunlight by the tall trees, they were thriving. They gathered armfuls and took them back to camp. Taita offered samples of the wild harvest to Windsmoke. After due consideration, she nibbled one of his offerings, then nuzzled him for more. Taita assembled a large foraging party and took the men into the forest to show them the edible plants and to harvest them. Merrin took a second party, and they scouted at the edge of the forest for game. Two large antelopes were disturbed by the sound of axes and ran within easy arrow shot of the hunters. When the warm carcasses were brought into camp to be butchered, Taita examined them carefully. The male carried stout horns and had a dark, beautifully patterned hide. The female was hornless and more delicately built, her coat red-brown and soft. "I recognize these beasts," he said. "The males are aggressive when brought to bay. During the exodus, one of our hunters was gored by a big buck. It severed the blood vessel in his groin, and he bled to death before his companions could summon me. However, the flesh is delicious, the kidneys and liver in particular." While they were encamped at the pools, Merrin allowed his men to return to the diurnal pattern of activity. After they had fed the horses, he set them to build a sturdy and readily defensible stockade of logs cut in the forest to accommodate the horses and themselves. They feasted that evening on antelope meat grilled on the fire, wild spinach and herbs that Taita had selected, with rounds of durra bread hot off the coals. Before he retired to his mattress, Taita wandered down to the pool to study the night sky. The last vestige of the star of Lostris had disappeared, but there were no other celestial phenomena of import. He meditated for a while, but sensed no psychic presence. Since the escape of Soe, the witch seemed to have lost contact with him. He returned to the camp and found only the sentries still awake. In a whisper, so that he did not disturb the sleepers, he wished them a safe watch, then went to his sleeping mat. Windsmoke woke him by nuzzling his face. Sleepily, he pushed away her head, but she was insistent. He sat up. "What is it, my sweet? What ails you?" She kicked at her belly with a back foot and gave a soft groan that alarmed him. He stood up and ran his hands over her head and neck, then down her flank. Deep in her swollen belly, he felt the strong contractions of her womb. She groaned again, spread her back legs apart, raised her tail high and urinated. Then she nuzzled her flank. Taita placed one arm round her neck and led her to the far end of the stockade. He knew how important it was to keep her quiet. If she was disturbed or alarmed, the contractions might stop and delay the birth. He squatted to watch over her in the moonlight. She fretted and shifted restlessly, then lay down and rolled onto her back. "What a clever girl," he encouraged her. She was instinctively positioning the foal correctly for birth. She came to her feet and stood with her head down. Then her belly heaved and the waters broke. She turned and licked the grass on which the fluid had spilled. Now her tail was towards him, and he saw the pale, opaque bulge of the birth sac appear beneath it. She heaved again, contracting strongly and regularly. Through the thin membrane he discerned the outline of a pair of tiny hooves. Then, with each contraction, the fetlocks appeared. At last, to his relief, a little black muzzle peeped out between them. He would not be called on to perform a breech delivery. "Baka!" he applauded her. "Well done, my darling!" He restrained the urge to go to her assistance. She was doing perfectly well on her own, the contractions regular and strong. The foal's head popped out. "Grey, like its mother," he whispered with pleasure. Then abruptly the entire sack and the foal within it were ejected. As it hit the ground, the placenta parted and the sack was free. Taita was amazed. It had been the swiftest of thousands of equine births he had witnessed. Already the foal was struggling to break out of the membrane. "Fast as a whirlwind," Taita smiled. "That shall be its name." Windsmoke watched her newborn struggles with interest. At last the membrane tore, and the colt, for a colt he was, heaved himself upright and stood swaying drunkenly. He was breathing deeply from his efforts, his silvery flanks heaving. "Good," Taita said softly. "Good, brave boy." Windsmoke gave her foal a hearty maternal lick of welcome that almost knocked him down again. He staggered but recovered his balance. Then she started the process in earnest. With long, firm strokes of her tongue, she scrubbed off the amniotic fluid. Then she moved to place her swollen udder within easy reach. Already the milk was dripping from her waxed teats. The colt sniffed at them, then latched onto one like a limpet. He gave ferocious suck, and Taita stole away. His presence was no longer needed or desirable. At daybreak the troopers came to admire mother and baby. Horsemen all, they knew better than to crowd them. At a discreet distance they pointed out to each other the new foal's shapely head and long back. "Good deep chest," said Shabako. "He will be a stayer. He will run all day." "Front legs not splayed or pigeon-toed, he will be fast," said Hilto. "Hindquarters finely balanced, neither sickle-hocked nor hip-shot. Yes, fast as the wind," said Tonka. "What will you call him, Magus?" Merrin asked. "Whirlwind." "Yes," they agreed at once. "A good name for him." Within 10 days, Whirlwind was frolicking around his dam, butting her udder fiercely when she did not let down her milk fast enough for his appetite. "Greedy little fellow," Taita observed. "Already he is strong enough to follow when we go on."